Okay. Ah, it's working. Okay, good. Okay, so welcome everyone. We may, perhaps, if you are lucky, we may come to the end of the Mahapranayana Sutta today. It is always a risky thing to say because we've been doing it for 3 years, so we'll see what happens. But there is a slight chance that we might come to the end. And of course, we have already seen all the main events. The whole purpose of the sutta is really to show us how the Buddha passed away and all the events that lead up to his passing away. So all the kind of the excitement is kind of gone, or maybe not. Maybe there's some excitement after all, even towards the very end. So the things that we have left to look at are things like the Buddha's cremation ceremony, which might be interesting. And then after the cremation, the division of the relics of the Buddha afterwards is what kind of comes up next. And as always, when it comes to the sutta, there's always interesting things in everything. Even though we have kind of gone past the greatest, the very significant point of the Buddha's passing away, still there are interesting things in this last part as well. So just to remind you, we have seen the Buddha passing away, and then after that we have seen how everyone is just grieving and tearing out the hair and all of these kind of things, and how some of the more enlightened people, or some of the deities and etc., how they speak little verses in commemoration of the Buddha, like the Anicca Vata Sankara verse, a very famous verse that even to the present day is usually spoken at funeral services for anyone. But really, it is really only applicable at the Buddha's funeral, because Anicca Vata Sankara means all conditioned things are impermanent. Anicca Vata Sankara Upada Vaya Dhammino, the Upada Vaya Dhammino. They have the nature to arise, upajitva nirudanta, having arisen they cease, tesang vupasamo sukho, the ending of them all is happiness. That's what it means. But of course, that is really only relevant for the Buddha, because the ending of all sankharas is what happens to the Buddha. For most of us, that is just something we're aspiring to down the track. So that is where we're at, and now we have come to the point. There is a little sentence there. I think it's paragraph 612 on the one you have there. I'm going to be reading from Ajahn Suddhato's translation, so it's not going to be exactly the same, but hopefully you will be able to follow as we go along. And if you can't follow, please let me know. So then, after all of these things have happened, then it says Ananda and Venerable Ananda and Venerable Anuruddha, they spent the rest of the night talking about the Dhamma. Then Anuruddha said to Ananda, "Go, Ananda, into Kusinara and inform the Malas." The Malas, again, is the people at the place where the Buddha passed away. This is the Malayan Republic, one of the small republics in the north of India. And their capital is called Kusinara. That's where the Buddha passed away. So go, Ananda, into Kusinara and inform the Malas. Vasetas, the Buddha has become fully extinguished. Please come at your convenience. So Vasetas is the clan name of these Malas. That's the name of the leading clan in that city. That's why it says Vasetas. It's not maybe very obvious why he would say that, but that's what's going on there. "Yes, sir," replied Ananda. Then in the morning he robed up, and taking his bowl and robe, he entered Kusinara with a companion. Now at that time the Mallas of Kusinara were sitting together at the meeting hall on some business. Ananda went up to them and announced, "Vasetas, the Buddha has become fully extinguished. Please come at your convenience." When they heard what Ananda had to say, the Mallas, their sons, their daughter-in-laws and wives became distraught, saddened and grief-stricken. And some with hair disheveled and arms raised, falling down like the feet were chopped off, rolling back and forth, lamented, "Too soon the Blessed One has become fully extinguished. Too soon the Holy One has become fully extinguished. Too soon the eye of the world has vanished." So this is again the standard way that lamentation is kind of described in the suttas. It would make for a nice movie, I think, or something like that. It's kind of really quite vivid. And then you have this line that you see throughout the Mahapanibbana Sutta, this idea that too soon the Blessed One has become extinguished, too soon the eye of the world has vanished. And again, this beautiful idea that the Buddha is the eye of the world, the one who sees first, the one who understands the nature of reality, and then he gives us the opportunity to also see that reality by teaching us afterwards. But he's the one who sees first, the eye of the world. Yeah? Without someone kind of who leads us and who starts these things out, it's very hard to be able to see this reality because it is so profound. And again, it comes back to this idea that the Kalyanamitta, the Sapurisa, the Arya, the Buddha, is like the foundation of the entire spiritual life. Because without that initial input from someone else who has seen, it's very hard to make that breakthrough. And that is why there is an arahant path, there is the path to become an arahant, but there isn't really the idea of a bodhisattva path. It's not something taught by the Buddha, it's a later idea. And I personally don't think there is such a path at all. I think it's just a nice idea that came later on, but doesn't really have any support in the word of the Buddha. So, they grieve, and then they get to act together again, and then what happens next is then the mallas ordered their men. So then, my men, collect fragrances and garlands and all the musical instruments in Kusinara. Then, taking those fragrances and garlands and all the musical instruments and 500 pairs of garments, they went to the Malian Sal Grove at Upavattana and approached the Buddha's corpse. They spent the day honoring, respecting, revering, and venerating the Buddha's corpse with dance and song and music and garlands and fragrances and making awnings and setting up pavilions. So very active. It's a little bit like funeral ceremonies these days. Yeah, music, garlands like flowers. Fragrances perhaps. They went a little bit further with dance and song. We don't usually do that. At least not in the Western world these days, and maybe there are some places that do this. It's like almost like a celebration, the way it is done here. So, anyway. Then they thought, it is too late to cremate the Buddha's corpse today. Let's do it tomorrow. But they spent the next day in the same way, and so to the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth day. Then on the seventh day, they thought, honoring, respecting, revering, and venerating the Buddha's corpse with dance and song and music and garlands and fragrances, let us carry it to the south of the town and cremate it there outside of the town. So they keep on, things that they are doing. I suppose it is a way of lamenting and a way of kind of honoring the Buddha who has passed away, but maybe also lamenting and kind of honoring his life. And they obviously, because of the Buddha's importance, if you are a Buddhist, it is so important that you really want to do it fully, and keep on going for 7 days. And the idea that it goes on for 7 days is found in all the different versions of this particular sutta. So this seems to be a very early part of the sutta. But again, you will notice here the number seven. This number seven, which comes up in many strange places in the suttas, and always seems to be the number seven. When you read the Satipatthana Sutta, it talks about how long it takes to be enlightened if you practice Satipatthana, and it starts off with 7 years. Maybe not even seven, maybe just six years, maybe just five, four, three, two, one. And then after 1 year, it says, maybe not 7 months, six, five, four, three, two, 1 month. And maybe not 1 month, but maybe 7 days. And this idea of the word seven, or this number seven, is something that recurs in the suttas in many places. And it seems to have some sort of significance that is more than just an indication of an exact number of days or an exact number of anything. It seems to have a significance. And from what I hear from those friends of mine who are into this sort of thing, is that seven is a mythological number. And because it is a mythological number, it has like a cultural significance. And very often these cultural significances, they will creep into the suttas because they will say something to the listeners. When they hear the word seven, they will know that there's something important going on, or something special going on, maybe slightly magical or whatever. And it's fascinating that these things creep into the suttas. But usually it's not the Buddha who talks about the word seven, very rarely. He may occasionally, for example, you have the idea that if someone lies or says something really wrong in the presence of the Buddha, then their head will split in seven pieces. Yeah, it's another seven. So sometimes the Buddha may use this word, but generally it is in the narrative part. Yeah, it's part of the context around these things, where you get more of a feel for the culture at that particular time. And mythology and legend is part of every human culture in the world. Sometimes we think that, you know, one of the ideas of the modern world is to demythologize the world, to try to understand things in a more realistic and literal sense. But according to those people who study mythology, every culture has mythology, because mythology is an inherent part of how we talk about things and how we deal with the world. So in our world too, we have mythology. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but we probably have our mythologies. And only maybe down the track will we be able to look back and understand the mythologies of the present day. So it's not as if we are moving from a more kind of primitive society to a more rational one. Sometimes that may be the case. But it's also that many of these tendencies in the human mind, they're always there, they're always part of us. There's always irrational aspects, there's different ways of passing information on. And one of the ways of passing on information is mythology. Yeah, it's a way of telling stories, a way of looking at the world, which is different from the purely rational aspect. It's an important part of human culture. So when you see these things in the suttas, don't necessarily think that it is anything different from what we have now. It's just that now we may not even be aware of our contemporary mythology or legends, because it is just too close to us. We can't really see it. So that is the word seven, which kind of turns up everywhere here. Very common one. So at the end of those 7 days, then they decide that they are going to take the corpse, and they're going to carry it to the south of town and cremate it there outside of the town. Why to the south of town? Is there any significance in that? It seems to have been the common place for cremation grounds at that time. It was always seems to have been at the south of the city or south of the town. Whenever you see any city in India, whenever they do cremation, it's always to the south of the city. So maybe that was kind of just the standard place where you had cremations. Everybody knew where the cremation ground was or whatever. Maybe it was considered a slightly impure place or something like that. They kept it to one particular spot. So then it goes on. Now at that time, 8 of the leading mallas, having bathed their heads and dressed in new clothes, said, "We shall lift the Buddha's corpse." But they were unable to do so. The mallas said to Anuruddha, "What is the cause, Venerable Anuruddha? What is the reason why these 8 Malian leaders are unable to lift the Buddha's corpse?" Vasettas, "You have one plan, but the deities have another one." "But sir, what is the deity's plan?" "You plan to carry the Buddha's corpse to the south of the town, while venerating it with dance and song and music and garlands and fragrances, and cremate it there outside of town. The deities plan to carry the Buddha's corpse to the north of the town, while venerating it with heavenly dance and song and music and garlands and fragrances. Then they plan to enter the town by the northern gate, carried through the central town, leave by the eastern gate, and cremated there at the Malian shrine named the Makuta Bandana shrine. So, what is this all about? Why do the deities, why do they have their own plan for the cremation of the Buddha? Is that what deities get involved in, get cremation services? I don't know, I never didn't know they even had any. It's like almost like they have a cremation kind of company or something here, like the undertakers, the heavenly undertakers or something. I'm not sure. What is going on? And I think what is going on here is that did this really happen historically that the deities got involved? I really don't know. It seems unlikely to me. So I think what is more likely to be going on here, it could be because the deities are said to be disciples of the Buddha, so maybe they wanted to be involved a little bit, who knows. But I think it is more likely that what is going on is that, again, it's this idea of making the Buddha special, elevating the Buddha. Remembering the Buddha is not an ordinary being here, he should be treated in a special way here. So if the cremation ground was at the south of the city for everyone else, it wouldn't be appropriate to cremate the Buddha in the same place. Yeah, we can all relate to that. It would be, the Buddha should have a special place to be cremated, a place that is kind of agrees with his status as someone special, as a spiritual leader of utmost highest degree. And so you have a special place for him. And of course the Makuta Bandana place is a shrine of the Madeleines, and a shrine is a place where you go for spiritual uplift. Yeah, a shrine in ancient India, these shrines called Chaityas, they go back to the time before the Buddha, and there are places where people will go maybe to leave offering for the deities or leave offering for the ancestors, or they might just go there just perhaps to kind of to just do some rituals or some worshipping or something like that. So these were often in the forest outside of the city. There would be a special tree, a place that had maybe a positive and nice energy, yeah, where you felt lifted up, and all of these kind of things. And that would be a suitable place to cremate the Buddha, not a place where everyone else got cremated. So that kind of makes sense, yeah? You can see the general drift here is actually makes good sense. And then you have the deities intervening to give it a little bit more oomph, yeah? A little bit more power. And maybe the deities did intervene. Maybe there is something going on there. Who knows? I don't know. I tend to see things more in kind of natural, in more ordinary terms, but who knows what is possible in these kind of circumstances. So you have this whole different setup, taking it through a different gate, and then coming out a different gate because you want to go to another place rather than do what is ordinary for everyone else. And of course you have the divine song and dance and music and all these things instead of just ordinary worldly song, dance and music. Yeah. So divine song, dance and music, yeah. Sounds pretty good, huh? Have anyone here heard divine song, dance, and music before? Yeah. Hmm. Sometimes people have, yeah. Some of the people hear all kinds of things. You never know. It's just testing, yeah. Okay, so let us then move on. And then the Malans say, "Sir, let it be as the deity's plan." Now, at that time, the whole of Kusinara was covered knee-deep with the flowers of the flame tree, without gaps, even on the filth and the rubbish heaps. Then the deities and the Mallas of Kusinara carried the Buddha's corpse to the north of the town, while venerating it with heavenly and human dance and song and music and garlands and fragrances. And they entered the town by the northern gate, carried it through the center of the town, left by the eastern gate, and deposited the corpse there at the Malian shrine named Makuta Bandana. Then the Mallas said to Venerable Anuruddha, "Sir, how do we proceed when it comes to the realized one's corpse?" "Proceed in the same way as they do for the corpse of a wheel-turning monarch." "But how do they proceed with a wheel-turning monarch's corpse?" They wrap the wheel turning monarch corpse with unworn cloth, new cloth, then with uncarded cotton, and then again with unworn cloth. In this way, they wrap the corpse with 500 double layers. Then they place it in an iron case filled with oil and close it up with another case. Then, having built a funeral pyre out of all kinds of fragrant substances, they cremate the corpse. So I don't know how big this corpse would have become after wrapping it with 500 double layers of cloth. It would have been really enormous. I don't know how to move it around. But the point, of course, here is that this is just a way of kind of ensuring the proper combustion of the body. Yeah, if you have a lot of cloth and everything is kind of drenched in oil, it's going to burn incredibly well. I think this is the point here. And also recall that the number 500 is not usually meant literally. The word number 500 is usually meant to mean a lot. So who knows exactly how many layers of cloth there were. I don't think these things to be taken too literally. They're kind of just indications of what is going on. So I don't really know. Of course, the idea of new cloth makes sense. Yeah, the Buddha, again, if you want to look after him, you want to make sure everything is nice and pure. Uncarded cotton, I have no idea why it says uncarded cotton. I think yours there has a different thing, doesn't it? What does it say? What does it say on that one there? Teased. Okay. What does that mean? Okay. So teased cotton wool. Okay. I have no idea what that means. But uncarded means like raw cotton that hasn't been combed. It hasn't taken out the bad parts or whatever it is. I have no idea what that is about, but obviously it was considered probably a way of honoring the Buddha at that particular time. So lots of new cloth, and then they wrap it all up, and then they put it in an iron casket. And the idea, presumably, is that when you burn a corpse on a fire, if it is done in the open, it can have a lot of really kind of strange effects. Yeah, it can be, for example, sometimes the corpse may move because the muscles start to contract. It's not uncommon for the corpse to sit up, yeah, when it's being burned because of contractions in the muscles and the sinews or whatever. Sometimes some people say it can smell a bit like a barbecue when you burn a corpse like that. So it can be really kind of strange. Yeah. So all these strange things can happen. And presumably here, to have a dignified ceremony, you put it in a enclosed in an iron thing, so none of these things would actually be so obvious, because after all this is the Buddha and you want things to be as dignified as possible, and I suspect this is what is going on here. And there are other suttas where also other dignified people in a high position in society, like kings, that sort of thing, they are cremated in the same way. Similar kind of thing. Actually, it says even there that if you are a wheel-turning monarch, then you are cremated in the same way. So again, the wheel-turning monarch, in case you don't know, is one of the legendary kind of kings in India, that is supposed to have ruled the entire of the Indian subcontinent in all directions, and legendary because they ruled without violence. Yeah, they ruled purely by just traveling. It's interesting, it's actually written about in one of the suttas, and it's pretty hard to believe, but that is what it says. Yeah, the wheel-turning monarch travels to the east, and he says to the people, yeah, the kind of people he's going to conquer, said, "Oh, keep the five precepts." And they say, "Sadhu, sadhu, we want to be your underlings, or we want to be part of your empire." That's how he conquered people. Something to that effect. Yeah. So he just went out, taught the Dhamma, or taught something similar, something wholesome, and they knew from that they wanted to be part of his empire, or part of his kingdom. That's how he conquered the world. Yes, sir. It does. Yes, it's a mythological realm. Yeah, but yeah. That's true. They didn't read that. That is true. Yeah. But it's, the idea is kind of, the idea is there. Yeah. It's kind of an idea of the So, and what is nice about it, the point of it is that it was a magnificent king. That's kind of the point. It doesn't matter whether it's real or not, because the point is the comparison to the Buddha. Yeah. So it is true. It is a mythological thing. I think some people argue that there is some precedent for this in the earlier Indian texts, the Upanishads and the Vedas, that sort of thing, where they talk about certain kings. That it's also a mythology, but a similar kind of mythology which has been drawn into Buddhism from that, possibly an added Buddhist flavor to it, because some of these other ancient texts, they're much more violent and there's much more, you know, but then the Buddhist flavor is, okay, keep the five precepts, okay, please, we want to be your subjects because we keep the five precepts. That kind of the Buddhist slant on this. So that would be nice, wouldn't it? We, next time, maybe we should suggest that next time someone wants to invade somebody, kind of a new technique of invasion, just go and say, okay, keep the five precepts, see if that works. What do you think? It's going to work? Who knows? Yeah, if people are, sometimes people are more enlightened than we think, perhaps. Anyway, okay. Then, yes, and then it says and they cremate the corpse, and then they build a monument for the wheel-turning monarch at the crossroads. Yeah, and we have already looked at these monuments before. In your text it says a stupa. I think I have got both here. So in your text it says stupa. In the Adasudanta's translation it has monument. And monument is kind of nice because everyone knows what a monument is. A stupa is a bit more obscure, if you're not a Buddhist at least. And this is, as I mentioned before, this is the Buddhist contribution to world architecture, is the stupa, one of the few things that seems to have originated with Buddhism. And there are very few examples of stupa that are not Buddhist in the world. So it seems to be originally come from the Buddhist ideas. In the early days, they were very simple, but of course, later on, they were built up. And you have some, these days, you have some humongous stupas in the world. The largest ones are found in Sri Lanka, in Anuradhapura, in the ancient capital of Sri Lanka, where you have these stupas that contain over a billion bricks. And they're larger than the pyramids of Egypt. And so they are really enormous things. So the stupas is kind of one of those things that is a very Buddhist thing. And it started pretty much around this time with the corpse of the Buddha. That's where it kind of comes from. Built at the crossroads, yeah, for easy access. So, and that's how they proceed with a wheel-turning monarch's corpse. Proceed in the same way with a realized one's corpse. The monument for the realized one is to be built at the crossroads. Yeah, it just occurs to me who we're talking about. Maybe you know, the reason why they use an imaginary monarch is because any real monarch would be too ordinary. Yeah, if you kind of compare the Buddha to an ordinary monarch, because they would be obvious that they were just the ordinary human beings. So you compare them with some imaginary, legendary monarch, because they are everything in our imagination is much grander, and it's more fitting to compare the Buddha with that. There's an interesting passage in the Anguttara Nikaya, I think, or Sanghita Nikaya actually, where the Buddha thinks that thought, he has that thought, is it possible to rule without violence, without punishing and all these kind of things. And he never gives an answer, which is interesting. And to me, it is implied that it's very difficult, maybe impossible, to rule without any kind of, you know, violence, or, as you say, being bloodstained, because that's just the way things tend to be. If you rule, you have to, you know, it's kind of part and parcel of what's going on here. Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. And then he says, and these are things we have seen before already, so this is a bit of repetition here. When someone there lifts up garlands or fragrance or power or bows or inspires confidence in their heart, that will be for their lasting welfare and happiness. So the idea is that when you recall the Buddha, and of course you have to recall the Buddha in the right way, but if you do that, it will have a powerful effect, just as it has in the present day, if you really get into the recollection of the Buddha. And this is why the recollection of the Buddha is one of the bases of meditation practice. Yeah, this is one of those very interesting and I think important things about meditation, is that almost everywhere when it's described in the suttas, it is described as based on joy and happiness. And the Buddha gives a number of ways of giving rise to that joy and happiness. This is almost like one of the foundation stones of meditation practice. And of course, those things are Buddha-nusati, which means recollection of the Buddha, is the first one of those six things. Yeah. So if you recall the Buddha in the right way, if you understand who the Buddha is, and this is why one of the reasons why this sutta is so interesting, because it gives you a feeling for the Buddha. Yeah, human but extraordinary, that's kind of the Buddha. And you get the feeling for that, it actually gives you a sense of joy, because you know that there is something else in this world, something extraordinary, some access to real happiness, access to the ending of suffering, and all of these things. So it kind of, once you understand that you are in the presence of the greatest jewel available in recorded human history. Yeah. We get excited by so many strange things in our life. Yeah, when something goes well in our life, a small thing, you feel really happy. Oh, things are going well. Yeah, yay. But of course, it's all tiny. And before you know it, it kind of goes down again. But finding joy in the really good things in our life, the things that are really worth celebrating, actually, it's much harder. It's hard in the beginning. Once you get into it, it's easier. But hard in the beginning. It's kind of strange, yeah? Those things that are really the great blessings in our life, having the presence of the Buddha, his teachings, etc. It's more difficult to find joy in that than, yeah, I got a salary increase. So what? You got it's not going to make a big difference, yeah? I won the lotto or whatever. You know, people kind of get overjoyed by these things in their life, but it's not going to make much difference. It's nice, but you don't really understand where happiness lies, and that is the problem. So this is kind of why these things are very interesting, and these are at the very foundation of meditation practice. So you have the Buddha-nusati, which really what this is about. Yeah, you find joy and happiness when you go to these places, and maybe you know the Buddha relics are interred in that stupa. Or then you have the Dhamma-nusati, the recollection of his teaching, the Sangha-nusati, the noble disciples, Chaga-nusati, the recollection of your own generosity. These are all spiritual recollections, and these are the things that really are, you know, where you find a more profound and deep-rooted joy, a joy which is more sustainable and can actually lead to something very positive. The Sila-nusati, recollection of your morality, your good conduct. And the last one, which is a bit strange, is the Deva-nusati, or Devata-nusati, the recollection of the Devas, the knowledge that your conduct leads to all of these, at the very least, it leads to these very happy states of nice rebirth somewhere. If it doesn't take you any further, at least it takes you there. So here you have this thing right here included in the sutta, yeah? That is really what this is. It's a kind of a Buddha-nusati that you see right there. This is the purpose of the stupas. The purpose is not just to have all of these nice structures all over the place, yeah? The purpose is really to remember the Buddha. And if they work to do that, then it has a very great contribution to our spiritual lives. And of course, that is what it's all about. Okay. Then the mullahs ordered their men. So then, my men, collect uncarded cotton. The mullahs wrapped the Buddha's corpse and placed it in an iron case with oil. Then, having built a funeral pyre out of all kinds of fragrant substances, they lifted the corpse onto the pyre. So, getting ready for the funeral. And there you also know why in Buddhism we do a funeral. We do cremations, yeah, because cremations go back to the time of the Buddha. In fact, they go back much further than that. They go back to a part of Indian culture prior to the time of the Buddha. But this is why most Buddhists do cremation. This is why this is so common in Buddhism, because it goes back all the way back to that time. And the pre-Indian idea of it's interesting how culture decides what kind of burial or what kind of cremation you should have. And the ancient Indian idea apparently was that when you burn the corpse, then the fumes, the smoke from the funeral pyre and from the burning of the corpse, well, they go upwards. Because they go upwards, they go to heaven. Yeah, so this is how you kind of how you go to heaven, because all your body gets burnt and then you kind of move up to heaven. This was the kind of the Brahmanical or the idea, the Hindu idea, whatever you like. Before, at least that was what they said. I don't know if they really believed it, but that was kind of the idea. And then it goes to heaven. And then it became just part of the Indian culture to cremate corpses. And so the Buddhists also took that on board. But of course, Buddhists don't have the idea that, you know, the smoke takes you to heaven. But that is where it all comes from. Whereas if you go to Christianity, the idea is that you have to bury people. You have to bury them because your corpse is supposed to re-arise in heaven again. Yeah, you bodily re-risen in heaven. So if you burn the corpse, well, you can't re-arise. You've got to bury it. And not too many people believe in that anymore. But that is obviously the origin of where that comes from, the idea of burying your corpses. Okay, so now we come to another kind of interesting aspect of this particular sutta. It's a little subchapter called Mahakassapa's Arrival, or the story of Mahakassapa. Okay, now at that time, Venerable Mahakassapa was traveling along the road from Pava to Kusinara together with a large sangha of around 500 mendicants. So, Pava and Kusinara, these are the capitals of the two Malian republics. Yeah, there's two Malian republics, the eastern and the western one. And Pava is the capital of one of them, and Kusinara is the capital of the other one. So this was quite close together. And Pava is the place where the Venerable, the Nigantanatha Buddha, the Jain leader, where he passed away, a few months, or maybe a couple of years prior to the Buddha. So Pava was one of the cities in that particular area, very close by. So the Buddha was traveling on this road, and Mahakassapa is traveling there, and of course the Buddha had traveled on the same road just before. And again you have this number of 500 mendicants, not to be taken literally here. Then he left the road and sat down at the root of a tree here, or at the foot of a tree. Now at that time a certain Ajivaka ascetic had picked up a flame tree flower in Kusinara and was traveling along the road to Pava. So in other words, he was traveling in the opposite direction. And Ajivaka is one of these ancient sects in India. One of the famous six schools is the Ajivaka school. And they had their doctrine is actually mentioned in the suttas as well. So Mahakassapa saw him coming in the distance and said to him, Reverend, might you know about our teacher? Yes, Reverend, 7 days ago the ascetic Gotama became fully extinguished. From there I picked up this flame tree flower. Some of the mendicants there, yeah, this is now back with Mahakassapa and his disciples again, some of his mendicants there with raised arms, falling down like their feet were chopped off, rolling back and forth, lamented, too soon the Blessed One has become fully extinguished, too soon the Holy One has become fully extinguished, too soon the seer of the world has vanished. But the mendicants who were free of desire endured mindfully and aware, thinking, conditions are impermanent. How could it possibly be otherwise? Conditions are impermanent. This is anicca sankara. Conditioned phenomena are unreliable. Yeah, the conditioned world or phenomena are unreliable, are uncertain, are impermanent. All because everything is kind of built up by causes, so it's always unreliable. How could it be otherwise? Now, at that time, a monk named Subhadda, who had gone forth when old, was sitting in that assembly. He said to those mendicants, "Enough, reverence, don't grieve or lament. We are well rid of that great ascetic harassing us. This is allowable for you, this is not allowable for you. Well, now we shall do what we want and not what we don't want." That sounds like a good idea. So this is actually one of those interesting things in the suttas. There's a sutta somewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya. You notice there it says that he had gone forth when he was old. Yeah, and this is not a coincidence, because it is, generally speaking, much more difficult to go forth when you reach a certain age. What do you say, Jacob? So, because once you reach a certain age, you are much more set, in your ways. It's much harder to kind of change, and here you really have to change your lifestyle completely. You have to think about the world in a completely different way. You have to kind of accept all of these rules, and a lot of them are very minor and small, or so they may seem. And it's hard if you're older. When you're young, it's hard enough. What do you think? Hard enough when you're young? Yeah, okay. How old are you again? Okay, so not certainly not old. That's for sure. Okay, so good. So this is why it is far easier when you... Not that it cannot be done. There are some people who go forth when they're old and do it really, really well, and they practice properly. And Jacob Medin, you were... I'm not sure if you can hear me, but... I mean, So all of these things, some people do a really good job when they go forth, even when they're older, and it's not, but generally speaking, it's much more difficult, and the Buddha normally encourages people to go forth. The younger you are, the better it often is as a consequence. So then, that is why you have a combination between wanting to throw everything away. Now, good riddance to that great ascetic. That is just it's a little bit problematic. And of course, one of the things that happen as a consequence of this, and this may not be obvious here at all, but this is kind of setting up the scene for what later on becomes the First Council. What is known as the First Council is all the 500 monastics coming together and reciting the Dhamma and the Vinaya. And of course, this is one of the things whereby they realize it is necessary to have that council so we can preserve these teachings. Otherwise, we're going to have too many people who say, "Oh, just now it's time to chuck it all out, because we can have a more pleasant life without all of these rules of conduct, etc., etc." This, all of these things are kind of interlinked. You can see how there is a certain history here that is happening, and these things are there for a purpose. Then the Venerable Mahakasapa addressed the mendicants. "Enough, reverence, do not grieve or lament. Did the Buddha not prepare us for this when he explained that we must be parted and separated from all we hold dear and beloved? How could it possibly be so that what is born, created, conditioned, and liable to fall apart should not fall apart, even the realized one's body?" So again, he's just reminding them that of the Dhamma, one of the, again, as I mentioned before, the main themes of the Mahapanibbana Sutta is the idea of impermanence. The idea of impermanence, even the things that are most important to you. In this case, the Dhamma itself, in a certain way, it reminds you that the Dhamma itself is impermanent. So even the place of refuge that you have in the world is ultimately impermanent. The Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Buddha passes away first, and then everything else gradually disappears from the world. "Now at that time, four of the leading mallas, having bathed their head and dressed in new clothes, said, 'We shall light the Buddha's funeral pyre.' And they were unable to do so. The mallas said to Anuruddha, 'What is the cause, Venerable Anuruddha? What is the reason why these four Malian leaders are unable to light the Buddha's funeral pyre?' Vasetas, the Devas have a different plan. But sir, what is the deity's plan? The deity's plan is this. Venerable Mahakasapa is traveling along the road from Pava to Kushinara together with a large sangha of around 500 mendicants. The Buddha's funeral pyre shall not burn until he bows with his head at the Buddha's feet. Sir, let it be as the deity's plan. So, not sure. Again, it's hard to know exactly what happened historically, whether it was the deities or whether it was just known that he was coming, and that they were waiting, that there was maybe a messenger, or who knows what actually happened. But it is all, you know, as we have seen before, it is all a little bit sort of unusual, a little bit supernormal, if you like, as we at this particular point, the closer we came to the Buddha's death, the more kind of supernormal events can be seen. And this seems to be carrying on a little bit. Hard to know exactly what is happening here. Then the Venerable Mahakasapa came to the Malian shrine named Makutabandana at Kushinara and approached the Buddha's funeral pyre. Arranging his robe over one shoulder and raising his joined palms, Anjali, he respectfully circled the Buddha three times, keeping him on his right, and bowed with his head at the Buddha's feet. And the 500 mendicants did likewise. And when Venerable Mahakasapa and the 500 mendicants bowed at the Buddha's funeral pyre, the Buddha's funeral pyre burst into flames all by itself. So a lot of the kind of standard things you can see here, all the things that we do in the present day are mentioned here. The arranging the robe over one shoulder is exactly what monastics do now. It's the kind of this thing here, nothing has really changed. Putting your joined palms together, Anjali, it goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha and before. Respectfully circling the Buddha three times, just like we respectfully circle things in the present day, like a stupa or whatever. Always with the right side, this is how you circle the Buddha in the right way, or anything in the right way, keeping the right side towards him. So the bare shoulder is supposed to be towards the person you're circling. And then you bow down with your head at the feet of the Buddha. So all very similar to what you see in the present day. The culture, these cultural aspects of Buddhism, they go all the way back to the time of the Buddha, which is kind of nice to know. Okay, it actually I can see that in the translation you have, it actually says uncovering the Lord's feet. It says in there, it does not say that in this one. I cannot see that there doesn't seem to be anything in the Pali to suggest uncovering the feet. I think that, not sure why he has that. Could be a mistranslation on the part of Maurice Walsh, because he does have a few mistranslations. It just seems that he did the circumambulation and then bowed down. That seems to be what it is about. Okay. Yes. Doesn't say relics. Oh, you haven't got there yet.
Oh.
You're ahead of me. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, come back in a second, Eddie, once we have read it out. Yeah. Yeah. Not in the Pali. Not in the Pali that I have here, but the Pali. Yeah. Yeah. After he was dead? Yeah. Ananda. The Buddha lifted his feet. But the Buddha's dead already. He can't use it. Yeah. Yeah, I.
Yeah.
It's in other versions. There's many different versions of the sutta. In the I think Sarvasivadin version, he doesn't actually uncover. He specifically says he uncovers the feet to pay homage. It says that in that one. That's why I was a bit unsure when I read it. But it says that in some of the version of the sutta, but in none of the versions does it say that the Buddha lifted his feet. That doesn't say that anywhere. Okay. Yeah. Must be some Mahayana thing, maybe something. Yeah, I don't know where that comes from. Well, it could be the deities, you know, or something like that, because they are the ones who stopped them burning in the first place. All these are probably legends, exactly. So there's just the degree of legends and degree of mythologizing. Yeah. So it's very hard here to pull apart what is legendary and what is historical. And the further away in time you go from the Buddha, the more you go into the commentaries, the more legendary it becomes, until you come to the point where, as you said, the Buddha lifts up his feet, or the Buddha enters the fire kasina and these kind of things. But that does not make any sense at all from a Theravada point of view, because the Buddha is entered Parinibbana. He's not there to do any of these things anymore. So it doesn't make any sense. That makes even less sense than these things. It isn't in the Pali, but it is in the I think that the Sanskrit version of the sutta, which is this is the Sarvastivadin version of the sutta. Let's have a look. So many things. Armies are coming out. There's lots of stuff happening at this particular point. The Buddha's passing away and the armies come. This is... Okay. Yeah, so then the Venerable Maha Kashyapa approached the pyre of the blessed. This is from the, I'm now reading from the Sarvastivadin version of this particular sutta in Sanskrit. Having gone up to it, he uncovered the iron vessel full of oil. He uncovered the 500 double layers. He uncovered the carded cotton. Having uncovered the carded cotton, he honored the undisturbed remains of the Buddha. Meaning, here the remains means the sarira, which is like the physical body, basically. It hasn't been cremated yet, so obviously means the body. Yeah, and then it has a different kind of carries on in a slightly different way. Anyway, so let's leave that to one side for now. These things are available around, so it's kind of interesting to compare a little bit. So usually the way we compare the suttas is that very usually the simpler version is usually more likely to be archaic and original. The more involved the sutta becomes, the more has usually been added to it. This is just the way things tend to be, especially with narrative sections like this, because a narrative was not laid down by the Buddha. It was laid down by later generations, so it tends to be expanded and added to. And there's quite a few differences between the various versions as far as the narrative is concerned, but all the main important points are pretty much the same throughout. So he bowed down at the head, with his head at the Buddha's feet, and the 500 mendicants did likewise. And when Mahakasapa and the 500 mendicants bowed, the Buddha's funeral pyre burst into flames all by itself. And when the Buddha's corpse was cremated, no ash or soot was found from outer or inner skin, flesh, sinews, or synovial fluid. Only the relics remained. Let me just stop there for just a little bit. And one of the interesting things here is that the prominence of Mahakasapa in the Mahapanibbana Sutta. If you read the suttas, and you will know that Mahakasapa is not a very common figure in the suttas. There is a Kasapa Sanyutta, which consists about 15 short suttas on Mahakasapa, but generally he doesn't really feature very much in the suttas. The monks that feature the most are Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, the Buddha's right-hand and left-hand monks. We don't have them. Oh, don't have any of them here. And Venerable Ananda, yeah, very important because he is the one who remembers all the Buddha's teachings. So these are the ones that you actually find in the suttas mostly, whereas in Mahakasapa is actually a bit more of a marginal kind of character. But here he suddenly comes to the fourth. He becomes like the almost like the de facto leader of the Sangha, which normally would have meant that he would have been one of the most senior monks. That's how you become the leader by being a very senior monk, because the Sangha is kind of hierarchical in that sense. That's very likely to be the reason why he's given such prominence. And this is interesting because everyone is waiting for him to arrive. He is the one who kind of causes the funeral pyre to light by bowing down, then it kind of happens by itself. So he has a very kind of important position here. And if you read the Sarvastivadin version I was just reading from before of the same sutta, his position is even greater. And he recites a large number of verses not found in the Pali and all of that. And all that is fascinating because we know from history that Mahakasapa later on became a very important patriarch almost. He became one of the leaders of Buddhism, one of the kind of founders of many of the other Buddhist schools. And many of the Mahayana Buddhist schools and some of the other schools that trace their lineages back to Mahakasapa, as kind of the founder of their school or whatever. It is not really true because Mahakasapa didn't found any schools. This was long before the schools actually arose, but they still trace their lineage back to Mahakasapa. And this is really, I think, where a lot of that comes from. It comes from this, because you can see the prominence of Mahakasapa in the Sangha at this particular point. He was, obviously a great leader of what was going on. And then you can understand some of the history why he was so important later on. Perhaps, in part at least, from what is happening in the Mahapanibbana Sutta. He did, that's in the Vinaya. I think it's a story from the Vinaya. It's in the Kassapa Sanghuta probably, actually. Yeah, maybe right. I think it's one of the stories from the Kassapa Sanghuta. But there's not much there. It's not many stories with him here. That would be another symbolic thing probably. So there's probably a few things like that. Okay. And then you have this idea that the Buddha's corpse was cremated with no ash or soot. From any of the flesh or sinews, etc. And I think the idea behind this, and only relics remain, the idea behind this is that it was a very kind of, it burned in a very pure way. Everything burnt up and all that was left was the bone relics when it was finished, and nothing else was really left behind. This particular line is missing from the other versions of the sutta, so it may just have been come into the Pali for whatever reason, who knows what exact reason, but it's far from clear that it is, it is original or has anything to do with what actually happened historically. It is likely to be one of these things which is a bit of embellishment of what actually happened at that particular time. Whatever, it doesn't really matter. The relics that remain are the relics, and whatever you call them, ash or you call them relics or whatever, is kind of really irrelevant. So maybe just very briefly about the idea of relics. here is called sarira. In many parts of the Buddhist world, they're called dhatuha. Yeah, dhatu means like element. And the relics of the Buddha, they often be called that. In the Buddhist countries, you have the dagaba. The dagaba is a Sri Lankan word, a Sinhala word, which means a stupa, basically. Yeah, it's a dagaba. And the dagaba comes from the word, is derived from the word dhatu garba. And garba is a chamber, and dhatu is again the relics, yeah? So it's actually derived directly from the idea of a relic chamber. And that shows the close connection between the idea of a relic chamber and a stupa. The stupas were built around, ideally around the relics of the Buddha. That was kind of the purpose of these stupas. So this is what you are seeing here. So, what are these relics like? It is one of those interesting things, you know, in the modern world there's often a lot of emphasis on relics, and people get very excited about relics, having Buddha relics or whatever. And I personally don't get that excited over Buddha relics, to be honest. And one of the reasons is because I think the provenance or the origin of these Buddha relics is often so uncertain. You don't really know where it comes from or what it is all about or whether it has any connection to the Buddha. And sometimes when you see the amount of Buddha relics that is available around the world, you wonder how all that could come from one person. It's more like 100 people, you know, something like that. There's just so much of it. So it all is very dubious and uncertain. And one of the things that really kind of clinched it for me was when you see the a relic found in the museum in New Delhi, which is one of the most relics most likely to have come from the Buddha, because it came from a place that was quite possibly preserved all the way back to the time of the Buddha. It was dug out, and basically it is a bone. Yeah, it is not a relic as we normally think of relics now, where they have crystallized and they have multiple colors and all these kind of things, but it was an ordinary bone. So one of the relics that is most likely to come from the Buddha was actually an ordinary bone relic. And all of these other things about the Buddha's relics being crystallized because he was an arahant, and you can know whether someone is an arahant, whether the body bones crystallize, and all these kind of things. Personally, I find it all very, I find it dubious. So, again, this is just my personal opinions, and please don't feel offended if you disagree with that. It's just the way I see these things. And also another kind of piece of information that I heard from Korea was that when you burn a body at a very high temperature, especially bones, apparently they crystallize. Yeah? So if the temperature is high enough, you get crystallization. This is a natural consequence of burning things at a very high temperature. And that could explain some of the relics that you sometimes get. They are just bones burnt at a high temperature. Yeah? And that is how I prefer to look at it. It is just I think uncertain to decide that someone is an arahant based on the how the bones burn. To me, that is reliable way of deciding whether someone has a spiritual attainment or not. Okay, Eddie, go fire. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about now. That's what I'm talking about now. That when you know they say that if the bones crystallize, yeah, when someone dies, they say, well, this must be an arahant because the bones crystallized. That's what I just mentioned just now. This is kind of the idea of relics, and you find these little pearls, and you find they're brilliant and they're colorful and have all of these kind of aspects to them. I think the idea, to me, the idea that you can judge someone's spiritual attainment by whether you know you have a crystal or not left behind afterwards, to me, it seems very, very dubious, and I cannot see any connection between someone's spiritual attainment and how the body burns. It doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah. And I think I think it's just more like a popular idea, to be honest with you. Okay. So, there you are. So that is the only the relics remain. In other words, there would have been some bone fragments remained, and perhaps there would have been some of those had crystallized as well. Who knows what actually happened at that particular time? And then it goes on. It says, and of those 500 pairs of garments, only two were not burnt, the innermost and the outermost. Again, I don't really know what that is about. How it is that 500 garments were kind of he was wrapped in 500, but the innermost and the outermost were not burnt. Another kind of super normal event. And why is it even mentioned? And perhaps, I don't know, perhaps it is mentioned because maybe the innermost garment was kind of serving as a repository for the relics. Yeah, so it kind of would have been unburned, so everything kind of collected nicely. Maybe that's the idea, and everyone knew exactly what the relics were. I don't think this actually happened, to be honest, but this is, maybe the reason why it has been, the story has gone down in this way here. Why the outer garment also was unburnt? Don't know. No idea. I have no idea why that is the case. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah, no, that was the body, yeah. Where did it say that? Really? Okay, now I see what you mean. Yeah, okay, this version there, that version is wrong, sorry. This is what you cannot translate, cannot trust translations always. It's basically not wrong. If you read the Pali, I got the Pali here actually. So the Pali says, of those 500 pairs of cloth, two cloths were not burnt. It says not, nadayinsu means not burnt. So it's, unless he has a completely different version of the Pali. But Maurice Walsh is known for not always being fully reliable in his translations, so quite likely he has got it wrong. If you read the Sarvastivar and you read some of the other versions, they have exactly the same thing, that the innermost and the outermost cloth did not burn. So it's found across the board, it seems. So that is actually correct. So that's interesting, isn't it? How this is... mistranslation? That it didn't burn? I don't know. I don't think it happened. I think that's the point. I think this is some kind of idea that was probably added later on this is the Buddha's funeral. Something special happened, yeah? Something very special. The cloth was there. It collected the relics or whatever. The relics were kind of kept pure and clean because the cloth was intact. Something like that. That is what I think would have happened in this particular case. And once you kind of get kind of into the stream of supernormal, I've seen so many cases throughout the Panibbana Sutta of supernormal events happening and very often not being reliable because they're found in one version, not another one, etc. So I think once you get kind of going with supernormal events, they kind of pile up, yeah, and everything, almost anything becomes possible after a while. So I don't find this, I think this is just some kind of a memory perhaps that they had afterwards of something that probably never actually happened. Something like that. That is my guess. Okay. And when the Buddha's corpse was consumed, the funeral pyre was extinguished by a stream of water that appeared in the sky, and water dripping from the sal trees and by the mala's fragrant water. Yeah, so again the idea of a stream of water appearing in the sky. And again, the other versions are different. In the Sarvastivadin version, it just says that, in that version, it says that they used cow's milk to extinguish the fire. Yeah? So these are different ways of elevating the Buddha. Cow's milk would have been a very expensive way of extinguishing a funeral pyre. We're taking lots of cow's milk to extinguish a large funeral pyre. So very expensive. Yes, this is one way of elevating it. Another way is to say it was the devas coming from the sky. Is another way of kind of lifting it up and making the occasion more significant. So these are different ways. And the fact that they don't agree with each other, it shows you that the memory of what actually happened wasn't very clear. And that's why you have these differences. Then the Mallas made a cage of spears for the Buddha's relics in the meeting hall and surrounded it with a buttress of bows. And for 7 days they honored, respected, and revered and venerated them with dance and song and music and garlands and fragrances. Okay, so cage of spears, again, in the meeting hall, I guess the idea is that they were protected or something like that, probably the idea behind that, just a guess. And then they were honoring these things. Okay, it is 4:15 already, we still haven't finished the sutta. There isn't all that much to go, should we finish it off? What do people think? Is it nice to finish it off? Yeah? If you want to, because we want to do something else. Yeah? We're doing this now for 3 years. It's kind of time to move on to something else. I'll finish it off. But please, if anyone wants to leave, you're more than welcome to leave at any time. The rest is getting probably... Yeah, it is interesting in some ways, but less and less interesting probably. Yeah. So, now we come to the part about the division of the relics. So, King Ajatasattu of Magadha heard... that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara. He sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara, saying, "The Buddha was an aristocrat, and so am I. I too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. I will build a large monument for them." That is a mistake in Ajahn Sujata's translation. So, what it actually says is that I will build a large monument, a large stupa. No, I will build a stupa for them, and I will establish like a ceremony, like a ritual, an annual ritual or annual festival to worship or to honor those relics. Yeah, that's kind of the idea here. It's not large. It's actually a festival, is what it refers to instead. So even Ajahn Sujata sometimes gets it wrong, but he actually has it correct further down. So that's kind of the weird thing. But anyway. Then the Lichavis of the Sali also heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara. They sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara. The Buddha was an aristocrat, and so are we. We too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. We will build a monument for them and establish a festival. The Sakyas of Kapilavatu, so these are this is the family of the Buddha, yeah, these are the various people around in India. The Sakyas of Kapilavatu also heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara. They too sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara. The Buddha was our foremost relative. We too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. We will build a large monument for them. The Bulas of Alakappa also heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara. They sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara. The Buddha was an aristocrat, and so are we. We too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. We will build a monument for them and hold a festival. The Kauliyans of Ramagama also heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara. They too sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara. The Buddha was an aristocrat, and so are we. We too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. We will build a monument for them and hold a festival. The Brahmin of Vetadipa also heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara. He sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara. The Buddha was an aristocrat, and I am a Brahmin. I too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. I will build a monument for them and hold a festival. The Mallas of Pava also heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kusinara, and they too sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kusinara in exactly the same way. The Buddha was an aristocrat, and so are we. We too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics, and we will build a monument for them and hold a festival. So here you have 7 different groups. They all kind of want they want part of the Buddha's relics, and it's an interesting kind of group of different people. Some of these groups of people here are very obvious. It starts off with King Ajatasattu of Magadha, and of course he, Magadha, is the greatest country in India at this particular time. It's at the starting point when it's to become this large empire in the north of India, and King Ajatasattu was the king of this empire. So obviously he was a disciple of the Buddha, and he would want a share of these relics. That's kind of an obvious one, and that kind of also helps to elevate the Buddha a little bit. The kind of the royals kind of they get a bit of get some glory from the Buddha, and the Buddhist gets a bit of glory from the royalty. So they kind of build each other up. So it's natural that he should be part of this story here. So Rajagaha, and that kingdom was at that time the most powerful kingdom in the north of India. Then you have the Lichavis of Vaisali, which was another important republic at this time, and they were soon to be swallowed up by the Magadha Empire, but they still existed as a separate empire. The Vaisali being one of the great cities in India at that time. So both of these groups are natural for the Buddha, for them to desire the Buddha's relics. The Buddha often went to Vaisali. He also went to Rajagaha, the Magadhan capital, quite often. So there was a close connection between Buddhism and these particular kingdoms. Then of course you have the Sakyans or Kapilavatu. These were the Buddha's relatives. So obviously they also wanted some relics. But then it gets more interesting, because the next people here are far less well known. So you have the Bulas of Alakappa, and these Bulas of Alakappa, neither Bula nor Alakappa features anywhere else in the suttas, as far as I'm aware. Certainly not in the four Nikayas. So these are very kind of obscure people. Nobody knows exactly who they are. And it's kind of a little bit unusual that suddenly they turn up at the very end. After the Buddha's passed away, they turn up and they say, oh, we want some relics, and nobody knows who they are. So that's the Bulas of Alakappa. Then you have the Kolians of Ramagama, and the Kolians are a fairly well-known people, but the city of Ramagama is very obscure, and nobody really knows whether that city existed or not. It only again features here in the Mahapanibbana Sutta. There's no archaeological evidence apparently from this particular city or this town, so again it is quite obscure. Then you have the Brahmin of Vetta Deepa. Again, doesn't feature anywhere else in the suttas. Nobody knows anything about this. Why he should deserve just for himself. One fellow should have all these relics, whereas everyone else were kind of sharing them out according to nations. It's kind of a little bit strange. Don't know about that. Then you have the Mallas of Pava. So these are the other Mallas that we mentioned before. And they are not, they are a little bit more attested in the suttas. You see them in a number of occasions, but not super important in the suttas. So it's kind of strange. Here at the very end of the Buddha's life, you have all these kind of slightly obscure places who want the relics of the Buddha, whereas some of the places in India which you thought really would have wanted them are not here. What is missing here is, for example, the Kosian kingdom, the Kosala. The reason why Kosala is probably missing is because, according to the history, soon before the Buddha passed away, the king of Kosala also passed away, and he was a very close disciple of the Buddha, and afterwards he kind of handed over his kingdom to his son Vidudava, and he was a much more bloodthirsty and much more difficult king than King Pasenadi, and he was much more opposed to Buddhism and the Buddha. In fact, he is known in later Buddhist text to probably have slaughtered the family of the Buddha, or the entire Sakyan clan, because of a slight earlier on in his life. His mother was apparently of slave descent, when they said she was of royal descent, and for that reason he was so upset that he decided to slaughter the whole clan apparently. So this is some of the backgrounds. In that case, that makes good sense. You can see why maybe the Kosalan kingdom is missing from this list. But there are also, yes? It's not a certain story. It is uncertain. It's not in the suttas. It is a commentarial thing. So we don't really know. It features everywhere in the commentaries and later stories, but it doesn't feature in the suttas. But it kind of sort of makes sense here. Yeah, you can see it. So it kind of fits with the overall narrative. So maybe it was true. Maybe it was actually what happened. Yeah, could very well be the case. So, yeah. Very probably very recent. Yeah, yeah. Would have been the same age. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He would have been very probably had no faith or anything in the Buddha at all. Probably quite likely, if he wanted to kill all the his family or whatever. So probably probably was a lot of animosity there. So this is probably why it is not there, because it's kind of glaring by its absence. Yeah, it was one of those great empires that was so close to the Buddha previously. Yeah. But it's not just Kosala which is missing. You also have missing Varanasi, Benares, one of the great cities of India at that time. And the Buddha would have had many disciples there. But that's also missing from the list. You have Kosambi is missing. Kosambi also where the famous Gosita-rama was, one of the famous monasteries at that time. Also missing from this list. You have Champa, which is missing, one of the five great cities of ancient India, further away. So there's a lot of big cities that are missing from the list, and a lot of small little clans that are here instead. So this is kind of interesting. Yeah, and it is interesting because very often what happens, because this is, we're now kind of moving into the more hagiography of the Buddha. Yeah, when you come into the narrative and things, it is more a story to elevate the Buddha, to talk about his great qualities and all of these kind of things. So it becomes more of hagiography than actually real history. Yeah. And because of that, often things tend to get exaggerated, as we have seen with the miracles and all these kind of strange things. So because the people who are taking the relics here are relatively low-key, I think that is quite likely to be, more likely anyway, to be historically true, because it doesn't seem to be exaggerated. Yeah, this is kind of maybe just circumstances. These were the first people who heard about it because they were closest or whatever, and so they came first, whereas these other kingdoms may have been too far away, who knows what. And there wasn't this great urge to spread it out to kind of the great kingdoms, but more like, okay, you are our friends, yeah, so we know you, you were relatively close to the Buddha, so we pass it on to you instead of passing it out to the big kings or whatever of northern India. So something like that. So I think quite possibly this is true. But it is kind of still strange how obscure some of these names are, not actually found anywhere else in the suttas apart from here, the Mahapanibbana Sutta. Okay, so they all want the relics of the Buddha. And what happens next is that when they had spoken, the mallas of Kusinara said to those various groups, the Buddha became fully extinguished in our village district. We will not give away a share of his relics. You can imagine. Here, all of these kingdoms, all of these countries want to have a share, and they are this tiny little republic. This, the Buddha, not Buddha, the Venerable Ananda said that Kusinara was this kind of tiny little village in the back of beyond, nowhere, kind of irrelevant. Why don't you die in one of the big cities instead? The master said to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, this will do. Kusinara is fine, yeah? You can imagine here the pressure on these little melons there in north of India. And according to the story here, it actually resolves itself very nicely. But in some of the other stories, and if you read the Sarvastivadin account of this, if you read the Dhammaguptaka account, and these are some of the alternative versions of this particular sutta, it actually is as if it is war is brewing between all these countries. Yeah, so they all send their armies, the fourfold army, with which is the elephants, the horses, the chariots, and the foot soldiers, as the fourfold army of ancient India. They all send their armies, and they're all ready to fight. Yeah, fight over the relics of the Buddha. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it? I don't know if it actually really got to that point, or whether that's just history, or whether it really happened. But you can all, even in the Pali here, you get the feeling that there's some underlying tension going on. There's a problem here. But it's fascinating how we kind of fight over the symbols. We fight over the things that, the thing that really matter to the majority of humanity is not the actual teachings. It's not what the Buddha said. It's not how we should live up to the master, follow his example, but actually it is all the material things that really matter to most people, to the point where they're willing to throw the teachings completely out of the window and instead fight over these remnants and these remains. And this is quite a well-known story, this idea of the war of the relics. If you look at a lot of the iconography around the world, in other words, the art, yeah, that you see around the world, there's a lot of scenes where you see the fighting going on. That is the war of the relics that is depicted in some of these scenes. You can see them in some very famous Buddhist art. You find, for example, Borobudur in Indonesia. I think it is there. I can't remember now. You have the very famous art in places like Sanchi, the famous stupas in Sanchi in India. It has lots of art, and I think that is also featured there as well. And so this has become a very famous scene later on, this war of the relics, as it is called. But fascinating, yeah? And I think it is a very good reminder to all of us that the way to, you know, promote and look after the Buddha's teaching, to make sure that the Buddha's teaching has a good name in the world, is not to look after it by breaking the Buddha's message, by, you know, starting to fight over things and say that some people are bad because they destroy Buddhism or whatever. Maybe they are bad, but you fighting back and using violence is not the way to deal with these things. And it started straight after the Buddha, so we shouldn't be surprised that even in the present day these things are happening. But it's a good reminder of what really matters in this life. The Buddha taught his teachings not for us to worship the relics, not for us to have endless kind of rituals and chanting and what have you. The purpose of his teachings is only one thing really, and that is to practice them. That's when they have power. All this other stuff is kind of completely irrelevant, especially if it leads to this kind of anti-Buddhist behavior, which is kind of, you see here, from the very beginning almost. Fortunately, there was a wise person in the assembly, and he, what happened then was the following. Then Dona the Brahmin said to those various groups, "Here, sirs, a single word from me. Our Buddha's teaching was a forbearance. It would not be good to fight over a share of the Supreme Person's relics. Let us make 8 portions, good sirs, rejoicing in unity and harmony. Let there be monuments far and wide, so many folk may gain faith in the seer." The seer being the Buddha, of course. So you can see, again, I'm just looking at the one you have there. It's a bit different, but yeah, roughly similar anyway. Okay, so this is the good Dona who kind of saves the day. He's the hero here. And the answer is, "Well then, Brahmin, you yourself should fairly divide the Buddha's relics in 8 portions." "Yes, sir," replied Dona to those various groups. He divided the relics as asked and said to them, "Sirs, please give me the urn, and I shall build a stupa, a monument for it." So they gave Dona the urn. Then the Moras of Pipalivana heard that the Buddha had become fully extinguished at Kushinara. They sent an envoy to the Mallas of Kushinara. "The Buddha was an aristocrat, and so are we. We too deserve a share of the Buddha's relics. We will build a monument for them and hold a festival." "There is no portion of the Buddha's relics left. They have already been portioned out. Here, take the embers." So they took the embers. So these are the embers or the coals that were left after the burning. Yeah, just the wood or whatever. And they were happy with that. So this is actually more interesting than it may seem at first sight. So first you have the wise person Dona there. It's kind of fascinating because Dona is a Brahmin. Yeah. So it takes a Brahmin to help the Buddhists not to go to war with each other. It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? It's often like that. You need someone from the outside to kind of create harmony within a certain community, because you are all at loggerheads and you need an external mediator to sort things out. And this is exactly the thing you see here. It's a little bit embarrassing for Buddhists, isn't it? Right there, Buddhist history, this Brahmin comes in and sorts it out. It's kind of, oh. But it's fascinating, you know, it's actually right there in the sutta, and it doesn't look too good for Buddhists, so again, quite possibly it might be true, because it doesn't really look all that great. Usually the stories that are exaggerated are the ones where the Buddhists look really good and wonderful, but when it kind of goes against the Buddhists, then it's more likely to be a true story here. This is one of the methods used in analyzing ancient texts. When something speaks against the text itself, it is more likely to be true. It's one of the methods used to analyze text in this way. Yeah. Yeah. Could be. Yeah. 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 Call them Brahmin. Yeah. Yeah. So usually it would be called an Upasaka, though. That would be usually how it would be called, the Upasaka Dona, normally. Yeah. So because the Brahmins would also become Upasakas or Upasikas. So usually it wouldn't be called Brahmins. But it might. Or maybe he was on the way to become a Buddhist. Yeah, they wanted to encourage him a bit, so they kind of helped him along. I don't know. Yeah. Number of possibilities. Yeah. Don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. But the Buddhists were normally called them Upasakas. Yeah. 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 And then you have this little thing here of the Mauras of Pappilavana. They too heard, yeah, that the Buddha had become extinguished, and they too wanted to have some relics. And you can imagine that probably after the Buddha was burnt, all burnt up, probably would have been all of these people everywhere who heard about the Buddha been passing away. They probably all sent envoys and wanted relics. Yeah, quite likely. Probably from all distances and all kind of places. And there is a little bit of an indication that this might be true, actually further down. So who are these Mauryas of Pippalavana? It's kind of interesting. Do you have anyone has any idea who they might be? Maybe, I don't know. Why do you think that? Pippalavana. Oh, that was the Pippali cave that he stayed in. Yeah, it's very same as the Pippali cave, which is found. That's found in Rajagaha, one of the hills of Rajagaha, when you go there on a pilgrimage. Yeah, so that's true. It's actually a very similar word. That's true. Yeah, but what I had in mind here, what is interesting here, is the word Maurya. Yeah, because Maurya is from Maura, which means a peacock. So Maurya is like the peacock family of the peacock dynasty here. And there is a very famous peacock dynasty in India. That is Ashoka. Yeah, Ashoka Maurya. He was called Maurya. So his family was Maurya. So this would have been maybe 5 or 6 generations before Ashoka. Yeah, and of course, Ashoka's father and grandfather, they were also emperors of India. And they too were of the Maurya clan. So that may have been same clan that you find here as Ashoka, who later on became the emperor. So there's two possibilities. Either that clan really was a clan, yeah, and they existed already, and they actually did ask for them, and they were already disciples of the Buddha. That's one possibility. Or maybe it has been added for some reason, because it kind of is nice, both for Buddhists and for Ashoka, to be kind of related to each other in this way. Yeah, it kind of glorifies both sides a little bit. So what is most likely here? And again, to find this out, what you have to do is you have to look at the parallel texts. So if you look at the Sarvastivadin text and you look at the Dharmaguptaka text, the two other sources that we have, in neither of those actually mention the Mauryas. What they mention instead, they mention the people of Pippalavana, and one of them has a completely different word, or not a similar kind of word, but with a different meaning again. So here, in this case, it seems like the Pali text, somehow, this idea of Maurya has been added, but it may, in fact, have been just the people from Pippalavana. They may not have had any original mention of Maurya in the sutta. And the word Maurya may have been added later on, because it was kind of auspicious, yeah, to have this the king and the Buddha kind of glorifying each other, because they were both have this, you know, because of the elevated status of both, in a sense. So that is that one there, and I'm just pointing these things out just to kind of try to understand how these things happen. yeah, in the history, how these things kind of get added and how the text kind of get expanded over time. But it's very interesting that it actually is there. It's the only mention of Moriyas anywhere, again, in the Pali canon. Okay, so they take the embers, so very humbly take the embers and are happy with that. And then coming to the very end here, the king Ajatasattu of Magadha, the Lipsuris of Vaisri, the Sakyans of Kapilavattu, the Bullas of Alakappa, the Kalyans of Ramagama, the Brahmin of Vetadipa, the Mallas of Pava, the Mallas of Kushinara, the Brahmin Doya, the Moriyas of Pippalivana, built monuments for their portions and held festivals in their honor. So here he has both large monuments and festivals, Adansudato, so this is, I think, slightly wrong, but it doesn't matter. Thus, there were 8 monuments for relics, and the 9th for the urn, and the 10th for the embers. That is how it was in those days. So that is Evangetan Bhutta Pubang. So you can see it's like they are telling a story. Yeah, it's almost like it's almost like once upon a time. And in fact, there is a starting point in the suttas which also uses Bhutta Pubang at the beginning of a story and almost means like once upon a time. It's a story about the past. And here is that feeling of someone reciting the sutta a long time after the Buddha, looking into the past, seeing this as a story. Yeah? Thus it was in the past. That is how it was in those days. So that is the original end of the sutta. Then comes a number of extra verses further down here. And these extra verses were added in Sri Lanka. It is specifically said in the commentary that these verses were added in Sri Lanka later on. But some of them are still in common with what you find in the Savasthivadin version. So maybe just useful just to read them out and comment on them very briefly here. There were 8 shares of the seer's relics. 7 were worshipped throughout India, but 1 share of the most excellent of men was worshipped in Ramagama by the Dragon King. One tooth is venerated by the gods of 33, and 1 is worshipped in the city of Gandhara. Another 1 in the realm of the Kalinga king, and 1 is worshipped by a dragon king. Through their glory, this rich earth is adorned with the best of offerings. Thus the seer's corpse is well honored by the honorable. It is venerated by lords of gods of dragons and spirits, and likewise venerated by the finest lords of men. Honor it with joined palms when you get the chance, for a Buddha is rare even in 100 eons. So that is another point where it might end the sutta, but actually it doesn't even end there, because there's another verse in the version that I have. They have different lengths depending on which version you have, but let's just very briefly just comment on what is happening here, because it's a little bit so it's just basically summarizing what's happened before. Yeah, it talks about the 7 bits that were passed around, and here you see interestingly that the one that was given to Ramagama, and these were the Mullins in the city of Pava. In Pava. Yeah, they were sent to the town of Ramagama, which was their city or whatever. It is worshipped by a dragon king here. Before, they sent the message that they wanted relics, and suddenly it is worshipped by a dragon king here. So what is going on here? It's a little bit strange, isn't it? How come it is worshipped by a dragon king all of a sudden? I don't know what is happening here. Maybe what is going on, maybe those relics were lost somehow. Maybe a stupa was never built, and then they needed some kind of explanation for what happened to those relics. And maybe they decided that actually the dragon king got hold of them, and this dragon king is now worshipping those stupas. Just pure speculation on my part, absolute speculation, but that's just one possibility for what may have happened. Then you have the next part here, and here we come to a very different type of relic. Now we're talking about tooth relics, yeah? The tooth, one tooth venerated by the gods of 33, one in the city of Gandhara, which is a long, long way from this part of India, all the way up into the northwest of India. Another, the king of Kalinga, king of Kalinga in the exact opposite direction, in the very east of India, south of the river Ganges. And the last one of his teeth, worshipped by a dragon king. So what we see here, we start to see this expansion of the idea of relics. Yeah, relics expanding. Suddenly we have these teeth. Teeth have never been mentioned before. And of course, tooth relics are quite famous in the Buddhist world. The most famous of those tooth relics is found in Sri Lanka in the city of Kandy. And they claim in that temple to have a tooth relic of the Buddha, which may possibly, maybe, have been one of the descendants, perhaps, of one of these things. And maybe that is the idea, anyway. Whether that tooth relic in Kandy really is a relic of the Buddha or not is very uncertain. And I think the evidence that I've heard is that it is definitely not a relic of the Buddha. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. So this is where these things come from very often. Yeah, you can see they have a long pedigree and they live on to the present day. And people, we keep on holding on to these relics in various ways. And then you just have all of this thing about worshipping the Honorable One. Yeah. So of course the idea here is that the idea that you... It's almost like you're building up this idea that by worshipping these relics, you're worshipping the Buddha and then you're doing something useful as a consequence. This seems to be what is happening here. So, yes, because seeing a Buddha is very rare in the world, but please keep in mind that this is often the problem in Buddhism, and this is what we see straight away even here in the Mahapanibbana Sutta. The problem in Buddhism is very often that we can tend to move away from the core teachings. What the Buddha says, we should practice, we should follow what he does. Instead, we start to do those things that he did not say, or things we shouldn't be doing, just worshipping and doing pujas and all of these kind of things. There's nothing wrong with doing that a little bit of ritual. This, of course, can be good sometimes, but it tends to go way over the top, and it comes from texts such as these originally. And then there is another verse which occurs only in some versions of the Mahapanibbana Sutta, not the version that you have. And just very briefly, I'll read it out as well. Altogether, 40 even teeth and the body hair and head hair were carried off individually by the gods across the universe. So even more relics. And now it is expanding even further. It started off with the bones and eight portions. Then we talked about some tooth relics. And now we're talking about every tooth, 40 teeth, as well as hair of the head and hair of the body. And all of this was carried off individually by the gods across the universe. So the whole thing just expanding out, becoming more and more. And of course, all of these things were added later. And it's interesting how the later you get, the more kind of these details kind of come out. The less certainty there would have been about those details, the more they're still expressed in the suttas here as if it is an absolute certainty, with details about the gods across the universe and all of these kind of things. Anyway, I'm not going to say too much more about that. Just point out that these things are late passages. Very briefly, I would just like to very quickly, this is a very ridiculously long class, I apologize for that, but just to very briefly summarize what the Mahapanibbana Sutta is about, because we've been doing this now for 3 years and very kind of irregularly coming and going a lot, and I'm sorry that it has been so broken up. It would have been nice to do it more continuously, but that is just the nature of things here at the Dhammaloka Center. And so what is this all about? What is really the message of the sutta? What are some of the lines? If you're going to draw things together, what is the purpose of all of this? And one of the main purposes of the Mahapanibbana Sutta, one of the things that you will have seen throughout, is the idea of impermanence, the idea of how unreliable the world is. Even the thing that is most important in someone's life, And of course, at that time, it would have been the Buddha, because he was the one who gave the Dhamma and gave the teachings and gave the spiritual path and all of that. Even the Buddha has to go away. And of course, if the Buddha eventually has to pass away, the Dhamma too eventually will die. Yeah, these are one of the few things we actually can hold on to in the world. One of the few places where we can find a real refuge. Why? Well, because everything else is much more uncertain. But even these refuges, unless we use them properly, they will disappear down the track. They too will be gone. They too are impermanent. So the message here is one of impermanence all the way through. First of all, the impermanence of the world, the unreliability of the world, how there's nothing that to really hold on to. And if you think about that in the right way, it will drive you on to the spiritual path, because that is where there's something reliable, something you can hold on to a little bit more. But in the final analysis, even that is uncertain. Even that will eventually pass away. So you have this opportunity, yeah? The opportunity is now. This is, in a sense, part of the message here. Now is the time to do the practice. Who knows how long these teachings will actually be available. And this, of course, is really problematic. So this is one of the, I think, very important messages of the sutta, the idea of impermanence, and how that, in many ways, summarizes the entire Buddhist outlook. If you remember the idea of impermanence, really, you are remembering a core aspect of the Buddha's teaching and his insight into the nature of reality. Another important part of the sutta, which is one of the reasons why it is so long and why it is so interesting, is because it has a lot of advice to us on how to live and how to function after the Buddha has passed away. Yeah, because the Buddha knows he's about to pass away, and this is how you live without me. This is how you cannot carry on without my presence. So a lot of very important topics that are mentioned here. Some of the most important topics in here is, in my opinion, that we should rely on the suttas, on the Buddha's word after he has passed away. And the reason this is so important is because the vast majority of the Buddhist world in the present day does not live like that. The vast majority of Buddhists, they rely on gurus, teachers, on lineages, all kinds of things. And it's actually very rare for people to go back to the word of the Buddha and to see what the Buddha taught. There's another very important message in this particular sutta, even though it is also found elsewhere. So these are, to me, maybe some of the two great takeaways. Some of the other things that are fascinating about this sutta is that you can see here kind of one of the things I've just been pointing out all the time is the increase in supernormal phenomena as you come closer to the Buddha's death. Yeah, a lot of supernormal phenomena adding up more and more as you come very close, as if people want to elevate the Buddha, they want to make him into something special. And yet, this is not really how the Buddha recommends that we elevate him. The way we elevate him is by practicing his path, by having the same results that he had in his meditation practice and his spiritual path, not by exaggerating supernormal phenomena or whatever. But this is a very powerful trend in Buddhist history. This is the beginning of that trend. After the Buddha, after we kind of go into the commentaries, we go into later Buddhist literature, this is the earliest Buddhist literature, it gets even worse. Yeah, the further away you get from the Buddha, the more supernormal phenomena you have, and the more distant the Buddha becomes from us as ordinary human beings. He starts to become a cosmic principle, a god, and all of these kind of things. And especially when you read some of the really later suttas, for example, some of the Mahayana suttas, just to take an example, they are full of, page upon page of kind of supernormal things and all of this. And it takes you very far away from the early Buddhist ideals of how the Buddha taught these things. So good to remember that. The Buddha's teaching is often very simple. It is very down to earth. It's about things that are very close at hand. It is not really about exaggerating and glorifying the Buddha in a way that he probably wouldn't have wanted to be glorified in the first place. So this is another important point in this whole sutta. And there probably are more important points, but I'm going to stop there. So does anyone want to say anything more before we stop? Or are you all kind of brain dead by now? If you're not brain dead, I congratulate you on your staying power. Okay. Yes. It depends, yeah, it really depends. It depends on what you can relate to. The advantage with the Sangha is that this, you still have a living Sangha in the present day, yeah, so you can actually meet some of these people. And sometimes you get the feeling that some people are just, they really have got it together, yeah, and you get the feeling that the Sangha is alive, there still are areas in the world, there are people who have insight into these teachings, and it makes the teaching alive in a very powerful way. Yeah? So sometimes relating to the Sangha can be easier than to the Buddha, because the Buddha is like, you know, it's just so far away, and it seems like it's almost kind of this frightening person to another. Some people get frightened by him. Obviously, he was completely unfrightening, but still, that happens. So this is the advantage of the Sangha. The nice thing about the Dhamma also is that it's still available as well. Yeah. So when you read these teachings and you find, wow, these teachings actually are really powerful. They really have something to say. They are dealing with problems that I can understand through my own personal experience. They explain the spiritual path in a very detailed and consistent and progressive way that I can relate to personally. So just reading the suttas, yeah, especially if they are, if you understand them properly, can also be very inspiring. Yeah. But I think at the end of the day, the highest refuge in many ways is the Buddha, because that's where it all starts from. Yeah. The Buddha is the beginning point. So without the Buddha, the other three refuges wouldn't exist. The Buddha is really kind of the crux, what it comes back down to. So if you're able to get a feel for who the Buddha was, yeah, this person who penetrated the darkness, penetrated delusion, saw the nature of reality for himself as the very first one, and that is really what it means to be a Buddha, the first person who penetrates and sees reality, and that is what is so astonishing, that ability to break through without a teacher. If you can get some feeling for that, yeah, and then he spent 45 years of his life just teaching here, for no other reason except compassion and kindness for all the beings around him. For him, it was probably a bit of a hassle. Yeah, having to teach everyone, having always to kind of argue with people wanting to argue with him, and then having to endure this and that. The Buddha would probably much rather just meditate in a cave rather than having to deal with all these things. And he didn't really like to hang out with people. He would disappear as soon as he could, usually. So if you get a feeling for that person, this extraordinary wise and compassionate person 2,500 years ago, and you can get a feeling for him by reading the suttas, by reflecting of him in the right way, sometimes we have Buddha statues that maybe can remind us a little bit about what the Buddha was like, if they are well executed and well crafted, then that can also be useful. So see what works for you, yeah, and how you can deal with it, and then you can find the best way of dealing with that. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Yes, please. The best way to do that, the best way to do that is to become a nun, you know, and then practice really hard, and then begin enlightenment. That's the best way here, yeah? Sometimes one of the things I think people often misunderstand what it takes to keep the Dhamma alive, yeah? Often they think, oh, we must kind of read the suttas, we must kind of convert other people, but that is not really what it's about. The main thing that keeps the Dhamma alive is having areas in the world, yeah, noble ones, like arahants and things, because when you see them, you realize, wow, it is alive, it actually works. So I think that is really what it comes down to. As long as we have people who understand this teaching from a personal basis, so long the Dhamma will be alive in the world. The moment we only have texts left, then misunderstandings will creep in, we won't really be able to understand, you know, to interpret them properly and all of that. So that is really where it comes back to. Are we going to be able to have how many arahants are we? Are we going to be able to keep on having arahants? I don't know. Yeah, maybe for a while. It's very hard to really predict these kind of things. Hopefully, be around for a while, but don't hold your breath. Yeah, because it's very, very uncertain. Yeah. Okay. Are there still questions from outside as well, or yeah? Okay. Gee. Okay. I Sure, we can probably do it fairly quickly. Okay. So we'll do a couple. Oh, wow, this is pretty cool. This first one is from Ghana in Africa. I don't think this is the first time we have a question from Ghana in Africa. So welcome, Mr. Ghana. That doesn't work, but welcome, whoever. Nice to have you here, and it's nice to see someone from Africa, because it's pretty rare that you are online here. That's great. The question is, how is the right way to recollect the Buddha to help progress of our meditation? The right way to recollect the Buddha. So I've been talking about this a little bit already, but the idea is just to understand that there is a person who has access to basically to the very meaning of life, who has understood what life is all about, understood the difference between happiness and suffering at the most fundamental level. Yeah, and this is just astonishing. Not only that, but this person has also understood the path to attain that very meaning of life, that very happiness and all that. So basically he has seen to the very core of what it is to be a human being, yeah, understands the human predicament, and has found a solution to the problems that human beings have, and found it at the highest possible level. And then spent 45 years teaching this beautiful combination of compassion and wisdom. Yeah, so it's extraordinarily powerful. There's nothing in the world more important than the Buddha, because it gives meaning to your entire existence, to what life is about, etc., etc. So extraordinarily powerful. Yeah, I'm not going to talk too much more about that, because I've been talking way too much already. So I'll leave it at that for now. But I think we have talked about these things before. I think if you search a little bit in the BSWA talks, you will be able to find something more about that. Question from Canada. Are there ways to start building the joy in the anusati to elevate those above that of e.g. arrays? Okay. Beyond just intellectually knowing it, or is it something that naturally happens along the path? It is something that happens naturally along the path, but of course it helps to help it along a little bit. Yeah, so you try to kind of incline your mind in a direction. You try to understand what the Buddha is about. Yeah, you put your mind to it, and as you put your mind to it, gradually you start to understand how these things actually come out. So you have to, it's not just about happening automatically, it's also about trying a little bit. And sometimes it can be useful to listen to talks about these things. People give talks about how to do Buddha Anusati, Dhamma Anusati, Sangha Anusati. I've talked about these things myself in the past. And that will give you some indication on how to do these reflections. One of the tricky things is to understand that the Buddha is an ordinary human being. That is, I think, very helpful to really have an understanding of the Buddha. But a human being who took the human potential to the highest level. And that is really what the Buddha is all about. So keep on reflecting, keep on practicing, and then gradually it should come together here. The last one is from India. How one can experience impermanence? Oh, okay, impermanence. It's very easy. Impermanence comes in many different levels, yeah? So you start off by just understanding the basic impermanence. Don't start off by thinking of the five khandhas or the five aggregates or the deep impermanence that you see in meditation practice, because it takes a long time to get there. Start off with the basic impermanence in your life right now. Look at the world, look at the climate, look at the world around you, things always changing, moving around, politics, whatever. Yeah, and you will see things are very unreliable, very uncertain, out of control. You don't know what's going to happen next. Look at your family life. Yeah, look at your understand that your family members, your friends, and everything in the world is impermanent and unreliable. It's a hard lesson, Buddhism. Yeah, it really kind of faces up to reality very kind of directly. Sorry. And because of that, you know, you have to kind of carry on with it for a while to really allow these things to get to the core, to really grasp you emotionally so that you it has an effect on your life. But these things are very important, because once you get that, you get why the spiritual life is so important. Yeah, the idea that you can develop your mind, that you have some control of your spiritual life, some control of your mind, you can do something about that. The external world is really completely out of control. This is number one, understanding of impermanence. Do that first. Then, when you have done that, then you move on to your meditation practice, and eventually you can start to understand the impermanence of everything that is all the five aggregates. Start with the simple stuff that get you started, and then carry on after that. Okay. I was going to say enough, but probably should more like say way too much. So, okay. So, well, anyway, thank you all for listening. Okay, let's pay homage to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.